Wednesday, IPO headquarters. Griffin became aware that he had lost his audience. Skuld was staring at the console with a slowly deepening look of dismay on her face. "Oh no," she muttered, then started prodding switches and changing display modes. "No, no, damn it!" "What's wrong?" Griffin asked. Skuld kept rechecking readings for a few more seconds, then seemed to stop herself toggling the displays with an act of will, steadied herself, and turned a look of mixed apology and alarm to him. It's not going to work," she said, as if forcing the words out. "The immunosuppressants had no effect. Her healing factor is killing the nanosurgeons, flushing the foreign material from her system before it can adhere." She raked her fingers into her thick black hair, pressing on her forehead with the heels of both hands. "We'd have to overwhelm it before we'd ever get anything to stick." Scowling at him, she went on, "This is presumably something the original inventors of this process discovered for themselves. I hate repeating other engineers' mistakes." She sighed. "I'll have to completely rethink the process, probably develop a whole new strain of nanos, and then only when I've doped out the exact mechanism by which her body's actually destroying them." "How long?" Skuld managed to crack a wry little smile as she replied, "I've got to figure out what's wrong first. It could be a problem with the liquid helium, or maybe the superconductors." She shook her head. "Days, maybe weeks." Griffin scratched his chin. "What about magic?" "Magic and adamantium don't get along very well," she told him. "I'm not sure it was specifically designed to be sorcery-resistant, but it is. Oh, I could do it. I'm a goddess, after all. But it'd take so much research and experimentation, we'd be better off just sticking to the technological route. That's completely uncharted sorceress territory, and you may remember this from the Ragnarok. When I improvise a big working, things tend to go in unexpected directions." She sighed again. "Of course, I could sub in adamantite. That takes magical direction just fine. But it'd probably kill her, because her healing factor isn't magical, and adamantite is, not really meant to be taken internally. Ditto for Uru, plus her bones would end up so heavy she wouldn't be able to move." Griffin said. "I have to admit I was sorely disappointed when I first learned that magic has rules. I always sort of assumed that was the whole point of it being magic." Skuld smirked. "Yeah, welcome to my world right around when we first met." She glanced at another indicator. "The skill dump is finished. We'd better get her out of there." She clicked on the intercom and tried to make her voice bright. "Laura? Hey, sorry to get you all dressed up with nowhere to go, but this isn't quite working like I was hoping it would. We're going to have to back on out of it and try again after I've had a chance to do a bit of a rethink." Her question was the same as Griffin's. "How long?" "I don't know for sure," Skuld admitted. "I have to come up with a new breed of nanosurgeons that can operate in your system. I should have realized you'd be so resistant to the ordinary kind. I'm sorry. It'll probably be a couple of weeks." "That will not do," said Laura, her voice ever so slightly sharp. Griffin frowned and left the control room. After initiating the automed shutdown sequence, Skuld had to trot to catch up with him as he strode down the hall to the main lab door. Laura was sitting up on the edge of the table, rubbing at the side of her neck where the IV site had already healed, when he entered. "Laura, what's..." he began, but she interrupted him. "There is a fully documented procedure for completing the Weapon X process," she said. "I know you possess this data. You must be able to construct the apparatus with the resources you have here." Griffin blinked at what she was implying and at her sudden vehemence. "Laura, the traditional adamantium bonding process is torture," he protested. The only person I know who's been through it barely survived, and he's the toughest SOB I know, which should tell you something. I wouldn't subject my worst enemy to something like that, much less you. Give Scold a couple of weeks. She can... I do not have a couple of weeks! Laura snapped, nearly shouting. Griffin gazed silently at her for a second or two, then said softly, Okay, Laura, what the hell is going on? Laura hesitated for a moment, then met his eyes and said, Kimura is about 24 hours behind me. He blinked. Huh. So she's not only still alive, she's found your trail after all these years. That's dedication. Then, smiling wryly, he went on, I tell you what, though, this is the wrong town to be pursuing a vendetta in. I know people. Laura shook her head. No, she said firmly. Griffin sighed. I was afraid you'd say that. You weren't even planning to tell me about her until we hit this little snag, were you? She shook her head. I have to say that hurts a little. I am sorry. I thought if I told you, you would mobilize your forces against her, and I must do this myself. She put a hand on his arm. You know that. Griffin rubbed a hand down his face, nodding reluctantly. And you really think this is the way you want to play it? I have never defeated her incomplete. He shook his head. I don't like it. I mean, I really don't like it. Laura moved her hand on his shoulder, looked him in the eye, and said in a gentler voice, You do not have to like it. Griffin looked back at her for a few moments, then sighed again, patted her hand, and turned to Scold. You'll find the specs in my personal files, he told her. Tell Vision I said to let you have the whole X-23 archive. The equipment shouldn't be that hard to put together. It's not exactly what you would call sophisticated. Have it ready as fast as you can. I need to make some calls. Skull didn't know quite what was going on, but she knew him well enough to spot how troubled he was by the situation. Ben, I'll take full responsibility, he said, then turned to leave the room. Just build it. 2335, Omega. One of the good things about the general frontier town semi-lawlessness of Omega was that there was no shortage of places for an enterprising outlaw to hole up and heal. Once they got out of the ruined underlevels and back to what passed for civilization, Griffin and his unexpected companion found sketchy but acceptably clean lodgings in the kind of res block that rented cubicles by the hour, day, or week. Judging by the sneer on the clerk's face when she saw X-23, she was expecting the visit to be one of the hourly variety, despite the fact that Griffin had paid for a week. After a shower, a large pepperoni pizza, a long sleep, and some fresh clothes, in that order, Griffin set to work modifying the StellarCom terminal in the room so that it, A, worked again, and B, didn't leave the usual sorts of forensic data traces, then made a call. The person who answered the call was a leonine-looking man with bushy side whiskers and old-fashioned clothes to match. Creed speaking, he said. Victor, it's Griffin. Victor Creed's face brightened. Good to hear from you, my friend. What can I do for you? For me, directly, nothing this time. I want you to meet a friend of mine. He gestured X-23 into the field of view beside him. Does she look familiar? Creed gave her a thoughtful look and then said, No, I can't say that she does. Griffin nodded to the girl. She held up her hands and deployed her claws. How about now? He asked. Victor's golden eyes widened. Oh my, he said. Then, shaking his head, he asked rhetorically, Where does Thomas find the time? I don't think he was involved in the conventional sense, Griffin said. In fact, chances are he doesn't know she exists, which I think we should do everything we can to prolong, don't you? Quite. Anyway, she and I are planning to go do something messy soon. Do you require assistance? Griffin shook his head. I wouldn't say no, but that's not why I called. I don't think there's time for you to get here anyway. It's just that when we're done, she's going to need a place to go. Obviously, she can't come with me. Creed drew himself up grandly and declared, Benjamin, in my wildest days, as you well know, I was a notorious rake hell. Since, I have spent rather a lot of time and energy and personal reserves to make good what I despoiled. With a courtly gesture, he went on, If this young lady requires sanctuary from my former friend, or indeed the galaxy at large, be assured that I give it freely and unreservedly. Once you've finished your errand, come here, and I shall give what succor I can to you both. Griffin nodded. Thanks, Victor. We'll see you soon. Good luck, my friend. Thanks. See you. Griffin switched off and turned to the girl. You don't have to come all the way with me, he told her. Once you point me in the right direction, as far as I'm concerned, you can head for New Snowdonia. Victor will take care of you. But you will still attack the facility. He got out his katana and started giving the edge a final honing. That's my aim, he agreed. Alone. If need be. X-23 shook her head. I will go with you, she said. I know the layout. If you're sure, he said. I'm doing this because I have to. It's in my dharma to fight people like the ones who made you. But you can be done with fighting, if you want, right now. Leave it all behind. She thought about it for a second, then said, It is all I know. He smiled grimly. I know that feeling. Then, rising, he picked up Ryu Natsume's scabbard and began sheathing the sword. The Klingon thought admirals teach us that revenge is a dish best served cold. In this case, I say. The blade slid home with a final decisive click. Nah. He put on his new coat, hung the sword on the strap he'd sewn inside for it, secured his other sword on the other side, and then turned a dark little grin to his companion. Let's ride, he said. Wednesday, IPO headquarters. Jeff Depew arrived in the Enrichment Center to find Griffin looking pensive and discontent, just barely not pacing up and down. A good-looking young woman stood over in the corner, arms folded. Her green eyes flicked to Jeff and gave him what his instincts told him was a very professional once-over when he entered, and she nodded cordially but did not speak. "You called, O'Chief?" he asked. Griffin nodded. "Thanks for coming," he said. "First things first, I want you to meet an old friend of mine." He didn't add, as he usually felt he had to when introducing women he knew to Jeff. Not in that way. But something in the air in here made the younger man think this was not the time to make that joke. So he kept silent as Griffin went on. Laura Kinney, Lensman Jeff Depew, SA-1. Hello, said Laura quietly. Charmed, said Jeff automatically. The part of his mind that was forever making these judgment calls, whether he wanted them on file or not, decided she was at least a Class B threat. Also that, though, or possibly because, she was making no effort to be so, she actually was rather charming. We've got a situation developing in town that may turn into full-blown craziness by midday tomorrow, Griffin said. I've got Lou handling all the official angles. But you need someone to look after a few unofficial ones. Jeff smiled. I can do that. What's going on? He turned and looked through the control room window into the lab itself. Skuld, a small team of technicians, and a ceiling track-mounted AI core were in there, clustered around the automed table and deeply involved in the process of converting it into... "What the crap?" Jeff murmured. "I assume Logan's told you about his less obvious bionic augmentations?" Griffin asked. Jeff nodded. "The bone reinforcements? Yeah?" Griffin gestured. "Well, that's our version of the machine they did it with." Jeff looked again, blinked, and turned back to the chief. "He also told me it wasn't a lot of fun." Griffin chuckled mirthlessly. "Understatement of the month." "Then what?" "It is for me," Laura said. "Excuse me, I think Dr. Raven here is ready for me again." Jeff watched her leave the room, then turned to Griffin and said, "It's for her?" "It's a long story," Griffin said. "She has the same innate healing factor as Logan, and she's had similar claws for years. Now we're finishing the job. At her insistence. An old friend of both of us is coming to town, and..." He sighed. "Laura wants, needs, to deal with her alone. Completing the Weapon X process gives her the best chance of surviving. What I want from you is to get hold of everyone you can round up from Class A and have them ready to contain. SAs 1, 7, 11, and anyone from Zero who can plausibly show up without going overt. All need to be on full standby." Jeff knew full well that the chief could have arranged all that himself in less time than it took him, Jeff, to ride the elevator down to this sublevel and walk down the hall. He wondered what message the man was trying to send to him, the SA contingent, or both, by having it done this way. The thought made him smirk slightly at himself. The day he could second-guess all the boss's motivations was the day he declared himself president for life. He nodded. "I'm on it." He turned away to start concentrating on all the calls he had to make. As he did so, he caught sight through the window of Skuld strapping Laura into the frame of the frightening contraption the automed had become. The thought of what she was about to experience sobered him, making him turn back to Griffin and ask, "Is she going to be okay?" "I don't know," Griffin replied honestly. "Are you?" Jeff asked, catching the tone of slightly desperate control in his voice. "I don't know," he repeated. Then, sitting down in one of the console chairs, he swiveled to face the younger man and went on, "I'm about to sanction something that goes against a good many of my principles. We're supposed to be the good guys, Jeff." Gesturing toward the fearsome engine into which Skuld was securing his friend, he added, "We don't torture people to create human superweapons. That's villain crap." Jeff considered that for a moment, then asked, "Is there any other option at all that lets you get this done in the time frame you have to work with?" Before Griffin could answer, he went on, "Because if the answer is no, and she understands the situation and has given her consent to doing it the hard way, if there's no other choice for letting her do what she needs to do..." He shrugged. "Then, speaking as another human superweapon experiment, as somebody who's been there, I say, do what you did with me, Griffin. The best you know how, to help out when it's all over." Griffin blinked. It was the first time he could recall that Jeff had ever called him anything other than Chief or Sir, and then nodded. "Thanks," he said. "I know it has to be done, or at least that she believes it does, which is good enough. It just leaves a bad taste." He sighed. "But you're right. It's her call. I just have to be ready to pick up the pieces." Jeff nodded. "For what it's worth," he said, "you're good at that." He turned away again, thought of one more thing, and looked back. "Oh, and speaking from experience, it'd be nice if you were in there when it goes down. I'd have given everything I had, which admittedly wasn't much, to have anybody in the room who gave a damn when the same kind of thing happened to me. Griffin got up from his seat. Yeah. Good idea, Jeff. He met Scold in the doorway, pausing to let her enter, and then lingering while she took her seat at the control console. Just for the record, she said without looking at him, I would not only not do this for anyone but you, but if you had asked me to do it to anyone else, I'd have laughed in your face, and probably punched you. And you'd have been right, he said. But Laura's special. Scold nodded. I could see that right away, she said. They made silent eye contact for a second. Then Griffin left the control room, went down the hall, and entered the lab. Stripped to her underwear and adorned with sharpied alignment marks along the lines of all her long bones, Laura was strapped flat on her back to what had once been the automed table, and now more resembled the working space of some demented horror movie dentist. She was surrounded by a small forest of articulated arms, each bearing what looked for all the world like a power drill. The technicians had all cleared out before Scold had prepped her. Only the glowing eyeball of Wheatley remained in the room, silently observing from his track on the ceiling. Okay, Scald's voice said from the intercom. Anomalous materials just confirmed that the adamantium supply is primed and ready. It's just about showtime. Not too late to call the whole thing off, though. Don't worry, Wheatley assured Laura earnestly. It's a standard human neurophysical response not to retain direct memory of really, really intense pain, the kind you're about to experience, once it's stopped. If you survive the process itself, you should be perfectly fine in 6 to 8 weeks. Wheatley, Scold snapped. Opposite of helping, we've talked about this. The AI core tilted downward, managing to look surprisingly abashed for a basketball-sized disembodied metal eyeball. Sorry. Go down to sublevel D and make sure the feed lines from AM Central stay stable. Righto. Well, goodbye then. Good luck. I hope you don't die, Wheatley declared, then slid sideways on his track and threw a wall hatch out of the room. There was a brief pause. I'm sorry about that, Scold said. He's a prototype. I understand, replied Laura with a faint smile. It disappeared as she looked up at the gleaming teeth of the apparatus, the faintest flicker of fear stirring in her eyes. Then she seemed to turn inward, centering herself in a manner that was very familiar to one with Griffin's training and experience, and was perfectly calm again. I am ready, she said. Okay, you'd better get clear, Ben. Griffin reached out and placed his hand briefly on Laura's forehead, smiling, then said, I'll be right over there. She nodded. Thank you. Good luck. He walked to the side of the room, outside the safety perimeter, quickly but carefully taped on the floor by one of the technicians, and stood where she could easily see him if she wanted to. Here we go, Scold announced. Powering up containment and cooling fields, now. The air around the apparatus rippled, acquiring a faintly bluish cast out to the perimeter tape. Looks good, verifying final injector positioning. With a faint whir, the arms swung inward, laser aligning their points with the alignment marks Scold had made on Laura's skin, then stopped just short of touching her. Last chance, Scold said. Do it, Laura replied without hesitation. Pater nain me irumabo, Scold murmured, and then in a clear voice, Injection sequence start in 3, 2, 1. 2335, Omega. The night shift security personnel were a bit surprised to see the rolling steel door in the deployment center start to open for no reason, and a bit more when it revealed two people standing there in the doorway, just as plain as you please. They were more surprised still when they saw that one of those people was their department's most recent target, the man who had been poking into all the dark places of the terminus lately, investigating the rumors of X-23. But all of that was basically just a warm-up for the deep, reverberating shock they felt when they realized that the person with him was X-23. They had nearly half a second to ponder that, before the man drew his swords, the girl's claws came out, and the killing started.
Neither she nor I bothered trying to stop anyone from sounding the alarm. Indeed, getting the alarm sounded was rather the point of the exercise. If we had wanted to infiltrate the facility without being detected, we would have done. Drawing the biggest possible security response was the whole idea. The nice thing about Genom Black Ops outfits from the standpoint of a person semi-obsessed with revenge was that they generally didn't have non-combatants. As a rule, the science teams were always armed and aggro, just like the security goons. No inconvenient ethical quandaries or innocent bystanders there. Well, in this case one, for some values of innocent. But I had that handled, or so I thought.
Fighting against each other, Griffin and X-23 had managed to carve a pretty impressive path of collateral destruction across part of the 4th District. Pursuing a common goal, they ripped through the facility like a tornado through a trailer park. Each always seemed to be exactly where the other's tactical needs required, sensing each other's moves cooperatively as readily as they'd done it while opposed. Security officers, tactical troopers, armed criminal scientists, and embedded combat boomers fell before them like grain. More than once during the 15 minutes or so of furious combat that followed, Griffin caught himself regretting that he and this unearthly child would have to part company when they were finished here. Under other, better circumstances, she would have made an almost ideal apprentice. Her spirit was muted, pushed into a corner by all that had been done to her in her short life, but he knew it was in there, and that it was strong, and he felt a certain kinship with it. They were both strangers in a strange land, out of place in the savage garden of the 24th century. Something Raoul Duke had once said about an old friend of his, and later applied to the WDF's founders, came to mind. We're high-powered mutants of a kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, and too rare to die. During a lull in the action, when they had temporarily run out of tactical troopers to fight and were making their way through the evidently deserted central res block area, he considered the situation. He suspected that, if he asked her, X-23 actually would go with him, but even as he had the thought, he knew that he could never do it. Drag a child, even one as peculiar as this, into the maelstrom that was his life nowadays? That would make him no better than the monsters who made her in the first place. No, she would be far, far better off on New Snowdonia with Victor. He'd give her a life. All Griffin could possibly offer was a different series of perilous emergencies. A kinder, gentler exploitation. But exploitation all the same. "Wait here," he said, and left her standing watch in the main corridor while he went down one of the branch hallways, following careful directions she'd given him before they arrived. His destination's outer door stood partly open, its lock panel broken. With a sense of danger and foreboding fizzing across his nerve endings, he slipped inside. "Dr. Kinney," he called softly. "Sarah, are you here? I've come to get you." He trailed off as he rounded the end of a built-in sofa and discovered that Dr. Sarah Kinney was indeed at home, but that she wasn't going to answer him. Out. Feeling time pressing, he knelt by the body and quickly checked for some indication of what had happened to her. That wasn't hard to work out. He might not have had much formal medical training, but he knew a broken neck when he touched one. "Damn," Griffin said. He straightened up and was about to leave when he noticed something in one of the dead woman's outstretched hands. Bending again, he gently prized her fingers away from what they held. It was a data solid of the kind used by most consumer-grade computer consoles these days. She hadn't been dead long enough for rigor to set in, She must have had a literal death grip on the module, which meant it had to have been important to her. He tucked it away inside his coat, took a moment to pay her a silent respect, then turned and left the room. "Let's go," he said, rejoining X-23 in the main corridor. "Where is Dr. Kinney?" X-23 asked. "She's not coming," Griffin said tersely. She understood at once, of course. Such things were part of the regular rules of the world she lived in. If she had any feelings about the news, she kept them, as always, to herself. Neither one had time for them right now, anyway. They were deep in the facility now, on what X-23's mental floor plan said was the administrative level, located near the bottom rather than the top, as it would probably have been in a normal office complex. They had to deal with one more security hardpoint, a fortified choke point in the hallway network leading into the central office area. That was the work of no more than a couple of minutes. The security setup in this place, Griffin had noticed, was configured with the expectation that attackers would be conventional paramilitary types with ranged weapons. Against a swordsman and someone who was essentially armed with chef's knives, the confined spaces of the corridor choke points and barricade areas hampered the defenders much more. After the noise and flash of the checkpoint battle, the halls of the admin area were eerily silent and dark. X-23, with her superior, indeed unlike Griffin's, extant, knowledge of the layout, had taken point as the two penetrated the dark heart of the facility. Suddenly, within sight of some kind of central atrium, she paused, quietly but intently sniffing the air. Then turned, her right hand's claws flashing out, and struck at the external controls of the door to her right. It opened to reveal a sandy-haired man in a lab coat, a blaster pistol in his hand. He had evidently been waiting for them to pass, intending to ambush them from behind. With an inarticulate curse at having been discovered, he raised his blaster. He got off a single shot, striking X-23 in the shoulder and knocking her down, then stepped out of the room he'd been hiding in and leveled the weapon at her head. "Little monster," he said with a sneer that was almost a parody of affection somehow. "Now that Kinney's been dealt with, you're my last loose end. This project is a complete wash, but we can always start again somewhere else. Maybe X-24 will be a little more stable." "Ah, Dr. Rice, I presume," thought Griffin, edging forward. He was musing abstractly about how pleasant it was going to be to take the man's arm off at the elbow. Rice had completely failed to notice that X-23 was not alone, when he saw her eyes first go flat as slate, then widen ever so slightly, nostrils flaring minutely below. She offered no comment on the prospect of X-24's stability. Instead, she brought her left foot up and across, neatly slicing the blaster in two with the claw protruding from the toe cap of her boot. Rice recoiled, swearing and grabbing at his hand as his trigger finger fell with the gun's remains to the floor. X-23 sprang to her feet and stood over him for a moment as he crumpled to his knees, cursing her. Griffin stood silent and waited to see what she would do. What she did, after regarding the man most responsible for the ordeal her life to date had been, was a rather peculiar thing. She put her claws away, and then precisely, methodically, furiously beat the tar out of him with her bare hands, and elbows, knees, and feet. A foot shorter and maybe half his weight, she nevertheless overmatched the man completely, deploying what Griffin's practiced eye registered as parts of at least four martial arts in the single-minded pursuit of causing Dr. Xander Rice to experience as much pain and debility as she had time to inflict upon him. This was not a teenager's tantrum, all flying fists and incoherent rage. This was payback. Grown up, fully considered, and administered with excellent technique. It was the kind of workover a man could expect from a renegade ninja whose clan he had wronged in a Tomodachi film noir. Griffin smiled faintly and darkly. "Guess I was wrong about her not being able to take it personally yet," he thought. At length, she stood over Rice, blood dripping from her knuckles, breathing hard, her fury not spent but possibly sated for the moment. He lay face down on the floor, a broken doll, groaning and wheezing, but evidently not mortally damaged. "Feel better?" Griffin asked mildly, advancing until he stood next to her. "Much," X-23 replied. "Shall we?" he asked, gesturing onward into the facility. She nodded. "Yes." "Planning to finish him?" X-23 gave the huddled mass a disdainful look, then turned away and said, "Not worth it," before striding off down the corridor. Griffin watched her go until she'd rounded the corner and disappeared. Then he crouched next to the bloodied, battered scientist and almost casually flopped him onto his back.
"She couldn't do it,"
Rice rasped, still managing to muster a faint smirk even under the circumstances. "She's welcome to her opinion," Griffin said, and then he plunged the short blade of Kankiri, his tanto, squarely into the middle of Rice's chest. "Me, on the other hand," he went on as the man gave one startled, gargling cry and expired, "I say guys like you are always worth it."
That's a very direct way of dealing with evil. It was the 2330s. "Get your murder on" was my default response to people like him back then. I mean, it is what we had done just to get that far. To be brutally honest, it was in many ways a lot more satisfying than due process. But don't quote me. "Hey, I didn't say it disapprovingly. Remember who you're talking to here. She who severs says hell yeah to that guy taking the express elevator to Muspelheim. No pun intended."
"Now I'll just loot your body, because that's how I roll," Griffin mumbled under his breath to the dead man, rifling his pockets for access cards and a credit module that displayed a startling balance when queried. Then he retrieved his weapon, cleaned it, and went on his way. X-23 was waiting for him around the corner. The look she gave him as he appeared made it plain that she knew exactly what he'd just done. With her senses, she could hardly have failed to hear it, nor to smell the fresh blood on him. But she made no comment as she led the way toward their final objective. By this point, the troopers and boomers had stopped coming. Once beyond the now deserted admin area, they were nearing the control vault for the central reactor. That was on the lowest or outermost level of the base. The reactor core itself, as such things often were on Omega, was mounted outside the pressure hull. As they entered the long hallway leading to the control vault, they saw a single figure standing between them and the door. By Griffin's side, X-23 palpably stiffened at the sight of her, a spark of real fear coming into her eyes. Griffin, sizing up the opposition, understood why. This was the third person to elicit any emotion in X-23's explanation of her life. A brawnily built, dark-skinned woman with an air of casual menace, she wore a lazily cruel expression as she took a couple of steps toward them.
Not content with isolating Laura from all traces of human warmth and kindness, and forcing her to murder anyone who broke that isolation herself, the warped geniuses of the facility decided to go one better. They found a pathologically abusive headcase named Kimura, managed to make her effectively invulnerable, a nifty science trick that I would have thought could have been put to better use, and then tasked her with terrorizing and brutalizing the girl whenever possible. Mainly, that took the form of setting Laura impossible tasks and then beating her savagely when she inevitably failed to accomplish them, then beating her again for fighting back even when she hadn't, all the while explaining cheerfully how and why she deserved all that and worse. I hated her with an incandescence that was remarkable even for that period of my life, and until that moment, I'd only ever heard her described. As for Laura, in those days, she was the only thing in the galaxy, as far as I know, that Laura feared. The trace of fear she'd shown during her fight with me was because her claws couldn't cut my swords, a trait she'd only ever encountered before when being tortured by Kimura. And now, here she was. We knew that would probably happen. We'd talked about it while we planned the op, but there wasn't a lot of time to prepare. I had a plan that I thought stood a decent chance of working. I just hoped X-23, as I still knew her then, would be able to hold it together in the face of her own, literal, personal childhood monster. To be fair, I'm not at all sure I could have in her place.
"You know," Kimura remarked, "when they woke me up and told me what was going on upstairs, I thought they were messing with me, I really did. No way, I said. No way is even the clone stupid enough to come back here after blowing a mission, much less come back and start tearing up the place. She shrugged. Shows you what I know, huh? She shook her head. You know what? I think I'm really going to have to kill you this time. I am not afraid of you, said X-23, audibly striving to make her voice as cold as she could. Yeah, you are, Kimura replied casually, and all three knew she was right. Griffin could almost hear X-23 trembling beside him. Kimura turned her eyes to him. They were flat, lusterless, like a shark's or a snake's. Who's your friend? She asked in a repellent parody of a friendly, chatty tone. He's kind of cute. Who knew you were such a fast worker, clone? Given her life experiences at this point, X-23 had no idea what Kimura was getting at with the fast worker remark. Neither did she understand the principles of the limbic fight-or-flight response in mammals. In that moment, she knew only that she had just gone from the most satisfied she'd ever been in her life to the least. She was trapped in a confined space with her nemesis, the world had gone red at the edges, and the only way out was through. She dimly registered Griffin's voice calling for her to stick to the plan, but by that point, he might as well have been shouting in Aramaic.
Before I could so much as move, X-23 had launched herself down that narrow corridor like a rifle bullet, the claws on her feet gouging deep furrows in the deck plating as she sprinted headlong into battle against a foe against whom her weapons were useless. One of the things that struck me about Laura almost from the very first, before I even knew her name, was this. There is no give-up in her at all. Not even the trace amount you find in the conventionally psychotic. If you broke every bone in her body but one, she would keep trying to hit you with that one. I know that because I pretty much saw that exact thing happen. It seemed like several minutes, but couldn't possibly have been, because I wouldn't just stand around sucking my thumb for several minutes while some invulnerable, sadistic roid freak beat a friend into a scarlet paste. The plan was out the window, and I knew I wouldn't fare any better if I launched my own frontal attack. I knew a technique that would probably avail me against Kimura's supposedly impenetrable skin. I wouldn't have been able to call myself a Katsujin Kenryu master otherwise. But in those days it was doubtful whether I could have concentrated enough to pull it off under these conditions. So I improvised.
Griffin expected his blaster fire to have only one effect, and he was not disappointed. It got Kimura's attention. Smirking, she tossed the limp and bloody form of her erstwhile opponent aside. Hey man, if you don't want to wait your turn, that's cool, she said, advancing toward him. I mean, I can always beat the clone to death later. Griffin let her come halfway up the corridor, then set to work. Jacking the power levels of his briars to full, he sprang into motion, laying down a blanket of fire that filled the hallway with blinding light and the scorched smell of ozone and burned thermocoat. Using all the focus and mobility he could muster, he stayed just ahead of her, dodging every attempt she made to grab or punch him, and kept shooting until both blasters overheated and went automatically into cooldown mode. By the time he was finished, they had almost completely exchanged positions, so that he was next to his fallen companion, already trying unsuccessfully to rise on broken limbs, and Kimura was halfway back to the entrance. Waving aside smoke, Kimura crowed, "Holy cow, are you a bad shot! Not that it would have done you any good if you had, but you didn't even hit me once!" Griffin gave her a nice cold smile. "I wasn't shooting at you," he said, then holstered his right-hand blaster and pointed downward. Kimura looked down to find the deck plates beneath her feet pitted, scarred, heat-warped, and creaking, and then, under the pinging sound of overheated metal, she registered a faint but growing, high-pitched, hissing squeal. "You son of a—" she said, but just then Griffin's left-hand blaster clicked back online, and he pumped one last shot into the floor at her feet. With that last insult, the whole warped and pitted area gave a tortured screech and then burst outward, evacuating the area immediately above it into space. In an eye blink, Kimura was gone as if she'd never existed. Holstering his blaster, Griffin threw himself to the floor, flinging an arm over X-23's huddled form. The outrushing atmosphere clawed at them, making the tails of his coat whip forward over his head. He drove Kankiri into the deck and hung on with all his might. 4 seconds later, emergency bulkheads clanged down on either side of the breach, isolating it, and the wind ceased instantly. Raising his head, Griffin yawned to pop his ears, then clambered to his feet and went to the little viewport in the bulkhead to have a look at the vented section. Empty. Nobody hanging on to the jagged edges of the breach. Nothing really to hang on to out there anyway. "Well," he muttered, "that'll hold you for a while." And then he turned back to kneel by X-23. "Easy there, slugger," he said gently, putting a hand to her forehead.